Coming up next is the Professor James McCanny Science Hour at the Crossroads. Now on shortwave, WWCR, frequency 5.070 at 7 p.m. Eastern on Thursdays, and also on Reality Radio Network Internet at www.realityradionetwork.com on Thursday evenings at 9 p.m. Eastern. And now, once again, here's your host, the Professor.
Good evening, October 4th, 2007, and there's a topic that I wanted to present last week, and by the way, I apologize for missing the show last week, and if you were not aware, I called up the networks and told them to please replay the show from the prior week, and very rarely, I will miss this show. So I do apologize. There were too many things happening at the same time last week. And so, once again, apologies for that. I will do the show this week, the topic that I intended to do last week, which was the weaponization or creating warfare in outer space. Now, the issues are very subtle. But the history is long and rich, and so the point I want to make in the beginning and the end is that, first of all, from our very first baby steps into outer space back in the 1950s, actually goes back to the 1940s, and of course World War II was on the verge, the German V-2 rockets were on the verge of going into outer space, a little step larger, and they would have had a space capability. But from the very first baby steps in space, the Russians and the United States both began to militarize outer space, see it as an advantage. And that is the key issue here. As human beings, are we going to take our warfare, our petty earth wars and paranoia and need to one-upmanship, you might call it, in this constant battle, what we called for many decades the Cold War, is now beginning again with the same mentality. Are we going to bring that into outer space, and can we bring that into outer space? I've talked many times before about the fact that Mother Nature has some other designs out there. There's some very big and bad things that happen in outer space, not related to human beings, but they're kind of like the hurricanes of outer space. Some people might call it an extraterrestrial intruder or extra solar system intruder. Now, I started calling Planet X, I started changing the terminology to extra solar system objects, and it's very funny, almost comical, how the standard science community grabbed that term and changed it almost immediately to mean planets in other solar systems. Extra solar. Now, solar refers to our sun, not a star in another system. So when they talk about extra solar objects being planets in other systems, that's just a way to diffuse the use of the term, meaning objects that come in to our very own solar system from outside. They want to totally diffuse this idea of Planet X, as some people might call it. Excuse me. But the whole issue with Planet X is that it's been made crazy and silly by very skillfully orchestrated disinformation campaigns. And that I caught very early on. I'm very tuned to disinformation campaigns. It's something that I've lived with and seen in the scientific community, and the Planet X was one of the biggest, longest-running feature disinformation campaigns I have ever witnessed. It started in the mid-1990s and was orchestrated to terminate May 15, 2003, with some planned suicide, Jamestown-type mass suicides, of people looking at a full moon thinking that it was Planet X. and carefully orchestrated with news media, radio shows, etc., with a whole host of players. Some of those players being people with, they're what you might call outreach employees of Standard Science. These guys that run around, they go to high schools, etc., to bring basically NASA's party line to the schools, telling you how great NASA is. But I'm diverging a little bit from the main topic here. The main topic is regarding weaponization of outer space. The point about the intruders from the outsider solar system, in other words, Planet X type objects, and remember, let me be specific, there are many, probably tens, hundreds, if not thousands, of extra solar system objects, big things out there that can come into our solar system and wreak havoc with our solar system. They don't have to hit us directly. Remember the terms I developed, action at a distance. Many things can happen without something hitting us directly. So, at any rate, without going into that in a lot of detail, the entire point is that Mother Nature has some very different plans for us than what our military coordinators have in mind. If we, here's the crux of the issue, 120% the crux of the issue is very simple. If we spend our space resources on military, and believe me, once you get into three dimensions, the resources are going to get spread thinner and thinner and thinner. We are going to have all our resources, time, and effort spent in placing military equipment in outer space, and the human race is going to sit back here. I'm going to talk about a topic. Our private entrepreneurs, the enemy of our very own military attempting to go in and control space. You'll find the term space control entering the arena here. And if they want to control space, then they certainly don't want a bunch of entrepreneurs running around up there watching everything that's going on, just having a good time. That's why you're finding Standard Aerospace corporations getting into the so-called space tourism industry to standardize it and keep those little unwanted entrepreneurs out of the picture. So there's a whole laundry list of issues surrounding that. Before I get going, because this entire show is going to be on this topic, there are so many aspects to this. I first want to talk just a little bit about the Berkey water filter, and I constantly get the response from people when they get their Berkey water filter and they've ordered it, they get it, they take it out of the box, they put it together, they put water in it, they pour the water in, it's just a container that sits on the top of another container, you screw in a couple filter elements, you pour in the water from your tap or whatever source, your well, whatever, and all of a sudden, a couple hours later, you're taking that first glass of clean, fresh water, and something happens. They realize that now they are their own source of clean, pure water, and that's really usually when the main realization hits of what they have in their hands is something that's portable. It'll work on a daily basis in your house. I use mine on a daily basis. I have a glass pitcher in the refrigerator, and that's what we use. We use it for cooking, use it for mixing of food, etc. And then if we travel, we take that with us on travel, even in the United States. And in case of emergency, that would be the one thing that I'd grab. I'd pour the water out of it that was in it. I'd put the top container in the bottom container, and I'd run out the door, and that's the one thing I would carry with me. If there were an emergency and I had to quick leave, if I were a block away or 100 miles away, I would have clean, fresh water. Anyway, without saying much more, I have developed a little expression, what's in your faucet? And, you know, of course, that's a play on that, credit card commercial, what's in your wallet? So I'll admit that certainly isn't an original, but what's in your faucet? Anyway, just quickly, Berkey water filter, the offer is the water filter and two filter elements plus two extra filter elements that you will need in case of an emergency, the free Kato WRX 911 shortwave radio that you can listen to on this show. It's what I carry with me when I travel. Small shortwave radio, that's free, and free shipping to the 50 states for $315. The manufacturer sets the price on the Berkey, but I offer those incentives to make sure that you get your Berkey water filter. And mail order address is JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392. Excuse me, once again, JMCC, P.O. Box 58, Navarre, N-A-V-A-R-R-E, Minnesota, 55392, or go to the webpage jmccsci.com. Seven letters, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. On with the main science topic. Now, the first thing I'm going to do here is read a letter. This is from the GAO, the General Accounting Office, and I'm wondering why they are getting into the business of writing to, at that time, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. This letter is dated 2002, September 23rd, 2002. And the reason I'm reading this letter, this opening letter to a study, a brief that went to Department of Defense from the GAO, General Accounting Office, Washington, D.C., is because this was the view 5 years ago. And I'll bring you up to date with current views on militarization of outer space. But I want to read this letter, some of the lines out of it. Our space capabilities enable military forces to be warned of a missile attack and to communicate and navigate while avoiding hostile action. I'm reading from the letter from the GAO to the Department of Defense, 2002. It continues, and they provide information that allows forces to precisely attack targets in ways to minimize collateral damage and loss of life. Now, listen to the next session here, or a sentence. DOD's Department of Defense satellites also enable global communications, television broadcasts, weather forecasting, navigation of ships, planes, trucks, and cars, and synchronization of computers, communications, and electric power grids. Gee, listen to all those great civilian things that we get out of our Department of Defense, which would all be shut down in a case of emergency. By the way, do we really want our military controlling those sensitive aspects of our personal lives? I think not. But they see that as a wonderful side effect of them having military satellites in outer space. However, the next paragraph is more telling. Listen to the terminology, space control, growing threat. These are terms I want you to listen to as I read this next paragraph. The growing dependence, however, is also making commercial and military space systems attractive targets for adversarial attacks. According to the Department of Defense, our adversaries, let me see, I didn't know we had space adversaries in 2002. But anyway, our space adversaries are exploring such capabilities as directed energy weapons, space object tracking systems, physical attacks on satellite ground station, and signal jamming. Moreover, our adversaries, there's that adversary word, the old Cold War, we have to have an adversary. I'm not sure who they are yet in 2002, but they're talking about adversaries in space. Our adversaries are gaining access to space-based information as well as acquiring new space-based capabilities. In view of this growing threat, Department of Defense is taking on efforts to strengthen its ability to protect and defend space-based assets, also known as space control. I'm going to read this last sentence. In view of this growing threat, Department of Defense is taking on efforts to strengthen its ability to protect and defend space-based assets, also known as space control. Given the importance and potential costs of its acquisitions related to space, we identified Department of Defense efforts to strengthen its ability to protect and defend its space assets and the challenges facing Department of Defense in making those space control efforts successful. This is 2002. Now, look at the logic. First, we put assets in space to support our ground troops. Big question being, has the United States become too dependent on high-tech space support for ground troops? Because any military commander knows that no matter how much superior advantage you have, it comes down to hand-to-hand, nose-to-nose combat on the ground. And that has absolutely nothing to do with your satellite systems, etc. The communications, everything comes down to nose-to-nose on the ground, your military man on the ground versus their military man on the ground. And there isn't a better example than this than the so-called war in Iraq, where our soldiers are being killed by the dozens, civilians are being killed by the hundreds and scores, because of very low technology equipment, explosive, and anything from handguns to knives being used over there, because you are simply nose-to-nose on the ground, which means that a handgun, in spite of all of our satellite technology and everything else, a handgun or even a knife or a crudely made bomb in the hands of someone who lives in that country has the superior advantage because they live there. And we are not there. We are have all our troops hunkered down in a couple of very localized areas. And so all of your high-tech machine guns, whatever you have, tanks, helicopter support, all of that is for naught because ultimately you are nose to nose with the enemy on the ground. And so, but the second point is that we are now embarking on defending the satellite base that was put up there to support the ground troops. So our offensive, our first step towards offensive use of outer space is to protect the military assets that are already in space to support our ground troops. Now, other countries obviously are seeing this. So, what's the problem with that? They realize that if their ground troops ever come under attack from the United States, if the resources of the world become diminished to the point where countries are fighting countries over resources, possibly water, timber, metal, precious metals, other important, sensitive, military, strategic materials and resources, or resources needed for the livelihood of the citizens of that country, that there would be a military assault and the satellites of the United States would be something that would help those ground efforts. So, obviously, that requires those countries to put offensive weapons in space to counter our supposed ground troop assets in space. You see the progression. Now let's revert back, 10, 20, 50,000 years to the cavemen, whenever the cavemen were around. The caveman is in his cave. He's got a few belongings, a couple tiger skins and maybe a woolly mammoth skin and a store of meat and some berries they picked, and that's about all they own, and they're living in their cave, and some intruder cavemen realize they see a smoke from the cave, they smell cooking meat, and they want it, and they're hungry. So all of a sudden, this is that great scene from the beginning of that movie, that Stanley Kubrick movie, 2001, the cavemen, or the apes basically becoming cavemen, are out there throwing rocks, and the one guy learns the advantage of holding a bone in his hand, and then they learn to throw it. So there is the first step towards militarization of outer space. And you can see that at that very early point in history, that, as I've said, I posted this on my webpage, that when the first caveman learned that he could throw a rock rather than just club the guy over the head, then that's where the advancement in technology, the advancement in methodology, and advantage, understanding the advantage in warfare with increased intelligence of man, whereas animals are very different. They are very much caught in their environment, and they do not control their environment. They don't change it. If with an animal or a plant, their resources become diminished, their population similarly very soon afterwards follows and becomes diminished. Humans are different. They can control their environment, and supposedly we call them intelligent because of this. The first stage of intelligence would be controlling your environment, using resources to your advantage, and becoming a successful species. But when warfare becomes the ultimate goal of the species, and the vast majority of resources of the society and the civilization becomes fixated on warfare, that is not intelligent use of resources. Clearly, if you can talk and there are enough resources to go around, then intelligent conversation certainly makes a lot more sense than warfare. Now enter outer space. Can we successfully go into three-dimensional outer space with military when the military thinks that everybody else should not be there, and that is their dominion? Listen to this sentence that I read out of this 2002 report to Donald Rumsfeld. In view of this growing threat, Department of Defense is taking on efforts to strengthen its ability to protect and defend space-based assets, also known as space control. And you find these acronyms littered throughout the literature today, and gee, the aerospace corporations are just giddy over the fact that now they have huge volumes of work coming down the line. And here's the problem. The people of the world have not had any say in this. It's like when Germany ramped up their war machine prior to World War II. It's when Eisenhower suggested and stated specifically that the military-industrial complex of the United States was its greatest enemy, and we're now seeing the full fruition of that. It turns out that the militarization of outer space is in a sense, the final frontier of the enslavement of people on this planet. Because we've already seen with Bert Rutan that private enterprise can go into space very easy and very simply. Now I want to talk about a guy just briefly named Fawcett, who was lost in his experimental airplane. Well, not experimental. It was a stunt plane, just a practice stunt plane. And now he was obviously setting records. That was what he did. And he was quite famous and set all kinds of records for aviation. He flew around the world. He has the longest distance air flight in a Bert Rutan-built aircraft sponsored by Richard Branson. And so these three made somewhat of a triangle. Rutan does the design work. Branson puts in the money. And Fawcett is the pilot. He's the guy that goes there. He's one of their test pilots. And so what I see happening here is he was about to set a land speed record, which was fine. But after setting all the land and air records that are in existence, he also went around the globe in a high altitude balloon and made some records in that particular category. Now, what do you think his next step might be? Knowing Branson, knowing Rutan, and knowing Fawcett. Well, gee, a rocket scientist could probably come up with outer space. Gee, how interesting. Now, let's look at some other people. Paul Wellstone. Let's talk about John Denver, a guy who many people don't understand. The point I'm getting at here is they're starting to take people out before they get to public notoriety or to get to their offices. Let's look at JFK Jr., another person that let's name directly, it's the Bush-Clinton cabal, and now Hillary. Where would Hillary Clinton be today if it weren't for the death of JFK Jr.? Supposedly that would have been, according to the experts, the senator race in New York would have been the biggest defeat, one-sided, lopsided political defeat, possibly in American political history, with JFK Jr. winning. And where would Hillary be today if she'd have lost that election? You're starting to see that people are taken out long before they become successful. Paul Wellstone, very likely a potential presidential candidate, not on the side of the big guys. Fawcett, where was he going? Obviously in the future, and they had to be talking about this in the Branson-Rutan world, that Fawcett would be looking to set space records, civilian in space records that could possibly dwarf what NASA has done. Look at what NASA is doing today as the front agency for black ops space operations. 20 years from now, maybe going to the moon again. 30 years from now, maybe going to Mars. That's all a big ruse and facade to keep the public thinking that space is difficult to get to. The Teacher in Space program. What is the subliminal message to kids? That the space is difficult to get to. Only NASA can do it. And this one teacher is your representative in space, and don't ever think you're going to go there, kids. That's the subliminal message of our teacher in space with NASA. So at any rate, let me take on a few other dimensions here. Just one more note on John Denver, if you wondered why I mentioned him. He was about to become, back I believe in the 80s, to become the first civilian in space. He was working with the Russian space program. Not a lot of people know this. Before his untimely demise when his plane crashed out in the bay, the San Diego Bay, running out of fuel minutes after takeoff. This was one of the Bush-Clinton favorite ways to get rid of pilots back in the MENA, Arkansas days, where the CIA and Clinton and Bush, the Bushes, were running the big drug operation associated with Iran-Contra. Now, people may be shocked at hearing this. Some people know all about it, but there's a good book on if you can find it. It's called Bush, Clinton, and the CIA Compromised. Is the name by a guy named Terry Reed. If you want to know all about this, read that book. So at any rate, the whole point here is now that space being the new frontier, who's going to control that? You find the Bushes are out right now very actively working, and Clinton, on water control around the world. These people have used public resources, public scientists, to locate the world water resources and are actively putting themselves and their agencies in place of controlling it, one of those agencies being the United Nations. So when you come to outer space, you better believe that those people know that that is bigger than big, and they want to be in control of it. And they don't want some small-time guy like Rutan showing them up. That's at least their front agency. So you have to understand the tiers of work that are going on. The military view that you see in outer space is just the front. The facade is to give that illusion to the public that this is what we are doing. We're doing it for your own good, for the defense of this country. What is well recognized around the world at this time is the fact that the United States, the people here, think United States good, oh, those people over there bad. But what people are beginning to realize is the United States foreign policy is strictly based on what the bankers, the international banking community in the United States, is the biggest mover and shaker of that international financial community. So what exactly is the United States up to in outer space? And one of the most successful ploys over the past 100 years has been, number one, the takeover of both Russia and the United States in 1913. In that time frame, the Bolsheviks taking over Russia, and we all are starting to find out who they were as related to the support of European bankers. And we also know what happened in the United States with the Federal Reserve, the phony money, the list of ongoing phony wars and phony individual taxes to keep the populations of these countries down and keep them subjected to the wills of these unscrupulous bankers. Now let's look at outer space. It's the same crew that wants to be in charge of outer space. Now, what do they need? What's the most important asset they need to pull this off? What they need is a big, long list of stupid scientists and engineers who will work for a paycheck and develop almost anything imaginable and beyond the high technology, the ability to train in on individuals and scour their individual lives. All of this being possible by scientists and engineers who simply are working for a paycheck and never ask the question, where is what I'm developing? Where is this being used and who is ultimately controlling its use? And how is this being used to subject my neighbors, my own family, to these illogical pastimes of the international banking community? And you have to understand this full circle, that the CIA is the police force of the international banking community, and every country has a similar intelligence agency that does the bidding, controls the elections, makes sure that people that speak out are silenced, makes sure that people like Fawcett, who might someday set space records that would be counter to their particular program of owning and controlling, there's that word, controlling outer space, to make sure that they never get where they want to go. Also, I've publicly stated that the little accident out in the Rutan facility this past summer was, my opinion, was sabotage. It's, I'm sure there are other people imagining that, and as I said on my webpage posting, it just seems that the Branson-Rutan team is having some bad luck lately. And, gee, isn't it interesting how that just happened after decades and decades of flawless, safe, and safety record, that all of a sudden people they know are having a few problems with the four people killed on the Rutan site last summer. Let me list some things that will never be discussed when talking about outer space and the militarization of outer space. The cost. What is the ultimate cost? When you start putting things up and you say, well, now we got to defend those items which are only used for our ground troops, and you start placing offensive weapons in outer space, what is the cost? And why did we need that support equipment in the first place? It was to give our boys on the ground an advantage to make it safer. And that certainly sounds like a noble objective when you realize that actually it could make it far more dangerous. If a country like China, if a country or any of the other laundry list of countries develops the capability to take these satellites out, and they already have that capability, our boys will be in far greater danger than ever. They will be isolated because they become dependent on technology that is vulnerable. And the entire point here is that now we have a shooting match going on in outer space, where we never had one before, and the entire reason was because the U.S. decided to put support equipment in outer space. Then they had to put offensive equipment there to defend this, and then all of a sudden they start seeing other countries saying, if we don't stop that, then the U.S. has a military advantage on the ground, therefore we have to enter space militarily. The Cold War thus continues. You see the paranoia that Iran or Korea and China could be our enemies, but isn't it odd that nobody talks about Russia anymore? I don't think people would buy another Russian Cold War, so they have to invent a new boogeyman. Cold wars are based on having a boogeyman, someone out there that you have to fear. And remember that the bankers don't care how many people get killed or die in the wars. They just know that their phony money is going to be scrutinized and become worthless if the rest of the world finds out what they're doing. So you have to understand all of the connections here to understand that weapons and weaponization of outer space is part of an ongoing program. Now, I'll just give a little example of things that I've seen personally. Back in California, let's look at about 1983. There were developments in our fighter plane technology that were very innovative, allowed our fighter planes a very definite military advantage over foreign made aircraft, including the French, Russian, Italian, etc. So what happens within days, I'm not talking months, I'm not talking years, it was like a race to bring this technology to Russia to be sold on the open market. And why is that? Because if they have it, then we have to continue the one-upmanship. In other words, if we would have stopped in World War II and truly protected our assets, including the nuclear bomb, including jet engine technology, including Russia, including rocket technology, the vast majority of the people in the world today would not have that technology. The splitting of scientists between Russia and the United States and intelligence, German intelligence and science between Russia and the United States, was no accident. That was the beginning of the Cold War, and assured that there would be a Cold War between Russia and the United States for the next 50 years, which in fact happened. Probably a good 40 years, very healthy competition, so to speak. And that included outer space almost immediately. Almost immediately, both Russia and the United States using military technology to go into outer space. Just an example, 1950, the first rocket to be launched out of what later became Space Center Kennedy, the Kennedy Space Center, but originally called Cape Canaveral at the time, was a German vintage V-2 rocket with a U.S. WAC Corporal second stage to go into outer space, and took pictures of Earth from a distance. That was one of the first applications, and so you see military space or rocket equipment was used initially to get the first access to space. And then from there on, the Cold War with the rocket technology. Now, I remember a small incident that actually started the understanding that the use of outer space for the ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, the nukes that the Russians and the United States were developing, there had two developments. One was multiple warhead entry systems. In other words, you have a single rocket, and once that rocket begins to re-enter the atmosphere, then all of a sudden a multiple series of nukes, up to maybe 6 to 12 nuclear warheads, would come fanning out and could actually reach different cities and different targets. So it made it extremely difficult to track where those were going. And when you had 1,000 rockets coming in and each one had multiple warheads, you had a problem, a defensive problem, a logistics problem. The other thing that came up, the technology, was to orbit nuclear warheads. So you had, you had a constant supply of warheads orbiting over the country in question, either Russia or the United States, and on any given moment, if somebody pushed the button, it would be literally seconds until those nuclear warheads would rain down on cities, destroying everything. And of course, the advantage, what finally people realized was the advantage was getting so close to ultimate destruction of both countries that they backed off and they created a treaty to ban outer space from military use, from nuclear weapons. It was a ban on nuclear weapons from outer space, which the United States now is ignoring unilaterally. And the Russians were very angry about this. The rest of the world was very angry about it. So when the United States starts pointing fingers at countries like Iran and China or Korea as being potential space threats, there is a, it's like the bully going down the street and he starts pushing people. And then all of a sudden somebody swings back and the bully goes, "See, he swung at me. He started it." That's what's going on here. Any child, grade school kid would recognize this pattern. And then the bully goes, "Well, I'm going to go back and get my troops because these guys started a fight and we're going to finish it and we're going to use all our resources." This is the kind of thing that the rest of the world, now you have to understand objectively how the rest of the world looks at the United States. And if you do that, you're going to understand that we are not favorably viewed by the rest of the world. And now, in light of that, I want to read another line here. This is from the magazine called Capitalism Magazine. It's on the topic of weaponization of space, designing a U.S. military policy. And I want to read the conclusion. And guess where this was from? The National Security Policy at the Heritage Foundation. The Heritage Foundation is a think tank, pro-U.S. capitalism think tank. But isn't it odd that this should appear in a magazine called Capitalism? Now, it's very interesting that two countries created two economic systems, and they went along with political systems. The Bolsheviks in Russia with communism and the form of their political system, which was basically the Politburo, and United States with capitalism. And so democracy, capitalism was somehow equated, and communism and the political system in Russia was also created as the dichotomy, the two poles of the spectrum to create the Cold War. And the two major powers of the world, both of them being controlled by European banking interests. Now, once again, you have to understand that the overseeing entities control this so that they can control the entire policy of the world. And they don't care how many wars there are. They don't care about suffering. They don't care how many people die, how many families' lives are destroyed. Because if they didn't do that, their vision is that they would become vulnerable and be eliminated. So that's their program. Phony wars, phony money, phony taxation, interest on national debt. I've always wanted to meet the guy that had so much money he could loan it to everybody in the world. And the only way you can do that is if it's phony money. There is no money. Now here's the conclusion of the weaponization of space study, Capitalism Magazine. And I want to read this. It says, "Space is a place. It is part of the geographic constant with which militaries have had to contend from the dawn of civilization. Now, space is something, according to this study, that is just like any other space, and militaries had to contend with it since the dawn of civilization. Okay, I'm going to read on. As with any piece of geography, space possesses unique characteristics that can provide distinct advantages to the military that is able to exploit them. Through the persistence and creativity, the United States now finds itself in a favorable position relative to other states regarding the use of space for military purposes. Its lead, however, should not be taken for granted. If the United States rests on its laurels and squanders this advantage, it will certainly regret it. Then it goes on, the final sentence. Indeed, much of the rest of the world would likely regret it as well. The likelihood is that today's emerging space powers, China, Iran, and North Korea, to name a few, are not likely to be the benign force that the United States is today and will be in the future. They show us good, them bad. And you have to understand the fact that China, Iran, and North Korea all do not buy into the European banker system. And there are monetary fights going on. Iran moving away from the dollar as a use for sale in oil. So isn't it interesting that all of a sudden they're part of the evil empire? China is becoming a major contender in outer space, having purchased their military and rocket and the equipment that the Chinese have, rockets, redundancy of systems, technology, and docking technology, all very difficult things to achieve in outer space, were all purchased from the Russians wholesale. That's what gave China an instant technological advantage in outer space. Let me go on to read some more of the items that are never discussed in talking about militarization of outer space. Additional tax burden on taxpayers to support a three-dimensional military system. What is the real objective? Let's look at this. I've never heard this question asked in any forum, whether it's in the magazines, in the trade journals, in Congress. Is the military planning on fighting an extraterrestrial war, a war with ETs? If they're going into space, I would think that Iran and China would be the least of their worries, but they never breach that question or talk about it. And as I've always said, don't bring a knife to a gunfight, because if there is an ET out there and they have the ability to cross the galaxy and get to our solar system, probably they've been around a little longer than these cowboys that we call our military. And so would we be bringing a knife to a gunfight, and we would be viewed, these civilians, would be viewed as supporting this. So we would be on the receiving side of whatever they decided to hand us. The point being that if the civilian population allowed their military to go out there and start bringing the petty wars into outer space, do they want this civilian population to exist anymore? Get the picture? That's a big question, and I don't hear anybody talking about that very real issue. Will more resources from this limited planet be moved into military military resources in outer space? Are they going to limit access to outer space for security purposes? And are private entrepreneurs the enemy also? Let me ask that last question again. Are private entrepreneurs considered by the military to be the enemy also? And the clear answer to that is yes, because if you're talking about space control, then you can't have these rookies or private enterprises going out there just bringing people out there for fun, because military control of outer space has to be complete. You can't have, in any war scenario, they confiscate boats or ships or anything else that they need in to create the advantage in warfare. So space would be no different. And so the entire issue of putting space-based operational equipment in orbit or in outer space, in three-dimensional space, and then claiming that it's being used for civilian purposes gives you two scenarios. One, we could have those capabilities anyway without the military, without the added burden of the military. And number two, in case of an emergency, all of those capabilities are going to be taken away from us. Get a clue, folks. That's why they're doing this. So, very simply put, when the first caveman advanced battle by using methods such as stockpiling rocks, storing rocks in strategic locations, throwing rocks rather than just hitting someone on the head, the inevitable occurs. Many times, or inevitably, these battles between cavemen were over resources, and the other obvious, inevitable, 100% guaranteed result is that the other caveman is going to see you doing that. And he's going to devise a better way to throw the rock, thus the rock thrower. How about putting a sharpened rock on the end of a stick and stab somebody with it? That way, that puts you, they're holding their sharp rock in their hand, and you have yours on the end of a stick. It's called a spear. Then you get a shield. That gives you an advantage. Then the other guy gets a shield. Then you develop the spear thrower, traditionally called a atlatl. It's an extended piece of hard material, many times a bone, in fact, or piece of wood that would extend your arm and throwing ability of the spear, giving you a definite advantage. How about the bow and arrow that carried England for 500 years through their naval and worldwide conquests, until gunpowder finally took over in the 1800s. But the archery, the longbow, from the time England attacked France in the 1400s, the English longbow literally carried the English. They had it on the ships. A lot of people don't understand this, that the archers would be up in the rigging of the English ships, so they would be able to clear off the deck of any humans prior to boarding it. Now, that was a huge advantage. So this gaining of advantage, using resources, intelligence, advancing military techniques, where is it going to end? And if it goes into outer space, it'll be the last frontier until it ultimately is the demise of the human species. Either by preventing us from getting out into space fast enough and getting far enough without the burden of military so that we can escape Mother Nature's natural disasters, or if there are ETs out there, they're going to come in and, very simply put, destroy our civilization, because why would they let us out off this planet to bring our petty earth wars with us and then have to fight us once we really get developed and established in outer space? It would be far easier just to wipe this planet out, lock, stock, and barrel, send us all back to the cave age, and come back in a few thousand years to see if we've figured it out yet. Gee, now it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that one out. So ultimately, the pursuit of military conquest in outer space is a dead-end street. And it may seem good to the bankers. It seems real good to the aerospace corporations, who are all humming around with their false patriotism because they get a pretty nice ongoing paycheck. Their stock prices zoom, and they can sit off in their nice, beautiful Beverly Hills house. The CEO corporations attend their nice parties, and our military boys can sit in a nice control room using satellite-guided laser technology, drones, and nobody on our side has to get killed, and anybody we want to kill on the other side is just fair game, like shooting ducks in a barrel. the entire issue of advancing military technology for warfare, it should have stopped back in the days of the cave age, and they should have sat down and said, look, if you just use a rock in your hand and I just use a rock in my hand, we're going to settle it this way. Nobody's going to get killed. One of us is going to get beat up pretty bad, but, you know, that's the end of it. Now the countries obviously had to develop armies and superior numbers, superior technology, and obviously the human species is not ready for outer space. That is a pure conclusion, foregone conclusion. And I've been to many talks, given many presentations in front of thousands of people. I've been on radio shows. I've talked with people all around the world. I've dealt with scientists. And no matter where I am or what group I'm talking to, I ask a very simple question. Very simply put, if you were an extraterrestrial, and say we were visiting another planet, let's put the shoe on the other foot. We are the space explorers. We finally made it to the next planet in the next solar system over, and we come down and we find out on some planet there's all these beings down there, and they're having all of the wars and the petty earth wars or land wars going on, and they're just about to emerge into outer space and take all their petty wars and militarization with them into space. What do you think we do? In the 100%, 110% answer, even from the military, even from the people in the military, would be we would have to destroy that civilization, send them back to the cave ages at least, if not completely obliterate them, because if not, we will have to face them in outer space someplace, because all they do is argue and meddle in each other's business, and they can't tell the truth, and they have no social skills that should be allowed in outer space. So the best thing to do is, like a beehive before it gets too big, you wipe it out. The best time to catch a beehive is when there's one or two bees there trying to create the nest under your roof outside on the backside of your house. That's the best time to get rid of a bee's nest, not sit there and watch it until it gets so big and uncontrollable that you're risking your life when you go out to finally destroy the bee's nest. That's just common sense. So even the military agrees that if they found a planet with all the warring and commotion and problems and insecurities and resource grabbing and, you know, lack of social skills, for lack of a better word, that the human race has developed and allowed their leadership. Here's the crux of the issue. A lot of people say, well, it's the leaders doing this, it's not us. The crux of the issue is that the civilizations, the populace has allowed the bankers to control this world, to control the wars, and it has gone on and on without end. So, what do you think about militarization of outer space right now? I'm actually out of time. I could go on for about 2 more hours on many related topics, but think about this, and think about the fact that the populace has no say in what is going on today, 2007, 2008. The U.S. has a line item for militarization of outer space. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.